This episode of See Here is dedicated to that purple sexy motherfucker, Prince Rogers Nelson. Rest in peace.
To episode 27 of the See Here podcast. Morris speaking here in Melbourne. I'm joined by my esteemed and knowledgeable colleagues. First of all, Mr. Bernard Stickwell in Bath. Good evening.
Good morning, Morris.
Indeed. Well, I tell you what, let's say good afternoon and we'll split the difference.
Oh, actually, looking at the clock here, it is good afternoon, so we can do that.
Good. Very good. And my other esteemed colleague in Seoul, Mr. Tim Merrill. Good evening to you.
Well, hold on for a second. I'm esteemed, but Bernie's the knowledgeable one.
Hang on.
There's something wrong with that, isn't there?
Right.
Anyway, hello out there, listeners, whether you're esteemed or knowledgeable or both. In case this is your first time listening, we talk about films that have music somehow as a thematic element. Not necessarily a musical, but somewhere music is part of the story, or musicians, whatever. Narratives, documentaries, welcome on board. We're here to entertain and inform you. And this time around, Tim, the esteemed and knowledgeable Tim, has gone and selected this month's film, which is...
Hardcore Logo, Bruce McDonald.
Out of 1996. What we'll do is we'll go for a quick break and play the trailer for you, and then we'll get on and start talking about this film. So we'll be back in a moment.
Say they make 6 G's. You know, they take my 15%, the van, food, gas. Hotel, 4 guys, 3,000 miles, 5 nights. At this point, you do it for love.
After a certain age, it's hard to make friends. And I've known Joe since I was 13.
It'll be my responsibility again to take care of everybody on the tour.
I mean, we've been through shit, and we've been through hell and back, and we know what it's like, and we still survived.
Like, this is a band, this is a gang, and if Billy's into it, and if John and Piper are around, I'll be doing it. And if they're interested, they'll be doing it with me. And if not, we'll see what happens.
And we're back from break. So you heard a little bit of dialogue there from the film, a little bit of the music. So let's give a bit of a IMDb précis as to what this film is about. So first of all, yeah, the film is Hardcore Logo from 1996, directed by one Bruce McDonald. And so what's the IMDb précis says? It says, Bruce McDonald follows punk band Hardcore Logo on a harrowing last gasp reunion tour throughout Western Canada. A magnetic lead singer, Joe Dick, holds the whole Magella together. I can't believe they use that word Magella. I'll read that again. A magnetic lead singer, Joe Dick, holds the whole Magella together through sheer force of will. All the tensions and pratfalls of life on the road come bubbling to the surface.
Whoever wrote that, that'd be slapped.
Yeah, that was pretty awful.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. Never mind. Well, that's why we're here. We're here to give them a better idea, a better synopsis of the film. Just keep listening. We'll give you an idea what the film's about, and then you can go off and watch it if you haven't already done so. And if you have already done so, we hope to do honor to the film and hope that we don't fuck up your expectations. So,
all you need to know is this. Fly on the wall inside a van, 5 dates, shit, fuck, piss, shit, fuck, piss, shit, fuck, piss. The end. That's it.
I killed a fucking goat.
Do we need to say any more about it?
No, you go on.
Next month, we'll be covering...
All right, I think we can do a little bit more about it. So, all right, let's do the round table thing. Okay, because Tim, this was your pick. Let's hear about your history with this film and why you picked it.
Well, I think this film is distinctly Canadian, but in a way it's absolutely not. Anybody who's ever toured in a band and basically lived inside the confines of a van for more than 8 hours at a time on road trips from one town to the next where you're lucky enough to make gas money to wherever else you're going, that's a pretty common experience, but I think this is a distinctly Canadian film in the sense that the film is an amalgamation of different Canadian bands, and especially the western part of Canada, which is basically almost like an apocalyptic no man's land. It can be to many that try to cross it. The singer in Hardcore Logo, Joe Dick, was actually played by Hugh Dillon, who was a singer for a band called the Headstones. And I was familiar with Bruce McDonald's work before this film, with Highway 61 and Roadkill, right, and the things he had done prior. And then I'd heard that he was working on the definitive Canadian punk film based on a book. No one had really had any idea what the casting was going to be. And then there was rumor that Hugh Dillon was up for the lead. And it was just like, that's perfect. He's already the lead singer of a band. But I think this film has a lot in common with Spinal Tap in the sense that there are a lot of moments that are funnier than hell to people that are strictly outsiders.
They see us on stage with tight trousers. We've got, you know, armadillos and all trousers. I mean, it's really quite frightening, the size.
But for anybody who's ever played in a band or had, like I said, the van experience, they would basically straight up tell you, that's not fucking funny. That's my life.
I lived that, yeah.
That's what a lot of people said about Spinal Tap, the same thing. I mean, it's as outrageous as it seems, you know, there's a lot of it there.
I know that there have been people out there who'd gone and made the obvious comparisons to Spinal Tap. I'd say, in a way, okay, look, there are some superficial elements. It's a story about a band on the road and a band who's seen better days. They're having this other crack at it. But I tend to think that the ultimate tone of the films are actually quite different. This is Spinal Tap. You know, they told definitely some home truths about guys in a band while taking the piss. And as you say, many saw it as a real documentary. Hardcore Logo certainly has some funny moments, and most of them due to Pipe Fitter, I'd say, the drummer. But I think essentially it's a drama. The core similarity, I guess, between the two films as well in terms of a relationship thing is you've got Nigel Tufnell and David St. Hubbins in Spinal Tap. It's, you know, really the film is about, a lot of the time, about their relationship. And in this film, there's a relationship,
right,
between Billy Talent and Joe Dick. But I think that there's, and you could argue, right, a case that in both films that the two main band members, they're like an old married couple, if you will. But I tend to think that there's a lot more drama going on in Hardcore Logo. There's the jealousy.
Oh yeah,
the jealousy that's going on in Spinal Tap is really more played for laughs, may for effect.
Sure,
but there's some, sure, serious stuff going on between Joe Dick and Billy Talent.
Where did Billy go? Where's Billy? Billy's gone. Uh-oh, where's Billy? Billy? Man, you scared the shit out of me when you time travel like that. Oh. Oh, it's good to see you back. You scared me.
I think the tone of Hardcore Logo is definitely a lot darker than Spinal Tap. And like you say, the relationship between Joe Dick and Billy Talent, it really goes to some sort of dark psychological places.
Yes.
I mean, it asks, right, questions about friendship, you know, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be an artist and things like that, you know?
Well, so, there's one film I was saying to Morris a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about it, and I said that one film that really seems to come up in my mind when I watched Hardcore Logo, believe it or not, was The Wild Bunch, because of this idea that there's this gang of guys that are basically become obsolete, that time has gone on, and it's basically they're being left behind, and that they're basically still going forward, even though they know it's not going to end well. And they're just basically walking straight into the sun and fuck everybody. They don't care.
I can see that. I mean, one of my notes is that it's almost like they are playing their roles in this, and they know that they are playing their roles in this. They know it's going,
right,
to end badly. And like you say,
right,
they're just walking into it because it's the choice they've made, and it's who they are, and it's what they know they have to do.
Right. And there's a code. And, you know, I mean, there's a, you know, I don't know if you want to call it a masculinity code or a punk rock code or whatever, so be it. But Joe Dick is the guy who tries to kind of adhere to the code, like Pike does in, you know, Wild Bunch, where Billy's the flaky dude. He wants to try to do it on his own terms, where it's kind of like, ah, man, you got to play it the way you got to play it. Like, you can't be fucking around with it. Like, you got to, you know, be honorable or fuck off, you know? In a way, Joe Dick, as a lead man, he's almost got this kind of warped kind of samurai code.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where he's kind of has to go out a certain way. He has to be a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's the only way.
Yeah.
And there's no veering away from that. There's no trying to kind of do it any less or any other way. It's just not possible.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And I think Hugh Dillon does a really good job of being basically a complete asshole, but at the same time, kind of hugely charismatic. And like you say, he's got this kind of warped sense of honor to what he's doing. And you can understand why he's being like that. I think it's a really good performance on his part.
And he's honest about it.
Yeah.
Welcome to the old days.
I want to step in, because before we started recording, I alluded to the two of you that there was a film that I'd been watching in the last few days, which I hadn't seen in about 10 or 12 years. And there was something about it that struck me as a similarity thematically to Hardcore Logo. Before I mention that film, I think we need to sort of give a more refined précis than the one that was on IMDb, so it'll make sense for those who haven't seen it. So basically, Hardcore Logo is this band which has seen better days, and they get together on the excuse that Joe Dick's mentor shot himself.
Bucky Haight. He hasn't shot himself. Somebody went and shot his legs out.
So Joe Dick says, I'm going to organize this benefit in tribute to my mentor, Bucky Haight, and I'm going to get the guys from my old band, Hardcore Logo, to get back together. We haven't seen each other in a few years. We're going to get back together with a bunch of other bands, and we're going to raise all this money to benefit Bucky Haight, because he's the man, he's the guy who was my mentor. And
He is punk
personified, but not all is as it seems. This is a three-act film. We discover something in the second act about Joe Dick's motives. Now, in the band, so there's himself as, you know, the obvious leader of the band. There's Billy Talent, the very ambitious guitar player who's finally got this opportunity. He's coming back for this one-off gig, but he's got this opportunity to join a band with a recording contract, and that could make it big. They're called Jennifer. There's the bass player, John Oxenberger, who isn't cool enough to have his own nickname. Without his medication, he goes off the wall a little bit. And then there's, of course, the drummer, Pipe Fitter. And unlike it's Billy Talent who's John Ross. I mean, John Oxenberger looks like John Ross, but it's Billy Talent who licks the knife. Anyway, but no, Pipe.
That's true.
Pipe Fitter is, you know, he's the one rock and roll figure. He's the cliched rock and roll figure. You know, the guy who lives for the rock and all the jokes.
He's the moon.
He's definitely the Keith Moon. All right, so the point that I wanted to make out of this was that Joe Dick has basically – so they get the band together to do this one-off gig, and then he suggests – oh, and Bruce MacDonald, the director, we get all meta because he hires Bruce MacDonald to make a documentary about the reunion of the band. And then, you know, Joe Dick says, hey, look, we're together anyway. Why don't we go do a five-city, five-night tour of Western Canada – and, you know, just relive some old times. The guys think, oh, yeah, okay, why not? So they go off. It's this road trip, this road tour. All right, so now to get to the point. Joe Dick, and we can sort of work out as we go along how many spoilers we give, but not everything that Joe has gone and said is completely the truth as his motivation for getting the band back together. But in his mind, he's gone and taken this unethical, immoral act to do for what he sees as the greater good. So the film that I was watching this weekend that had a very similar sort of a character with a very similar motivation was 1958 film directed by Orson Welles, Touch of Evil.
Told you I brought you up here for a reason.
Oh, yeah.
The character that Orson Welles plays, Hank Quinlan, is on the surface, he's this corrupt cop, and they're playing against the straight by the book, decent sort of guy, played by Charlton Heston, Miguel Vargas, Hank Quinlan, who's been in the job for many, many years. It comes out that he has gone and framed many of the people who he's gone and accused of crimes, including the main one in this film. But he basically says, I have this sixth sense because I work not by the book. I work by a feeling, a twitch in my leg. And I frame someone because I don't want to see them walk. So he takes an unethical stance for what ends up being what he knows to be the right thing. And, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch. But just watching that film today where Joe Dick goes and does... And we'll probably have to give this away. He basically hit the whole...
Well, no, I don't think we have to?
All right, okay.
No, well, I don't think so.
All right, we don't have to. All right.
Not that specific. Well, let's cross that bridge when we get to it, maybe. Okay, I don't know.
So Joe Dick has gone and basically gone and told a little bit of a porky pie to the other members of the group for what he sees as the greater good. And, I mean, I'm sure there are other films that, plenty of other films that have done that, but just having watched that in the last few days, it's strange how I could make a connection between Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and...
I can absolutely see that. It's interesting as well because Joe Dick thinks it's for the greater good, but is it for his own personal greater good, or is it actually for the greater good of... And you know, that sort of throws up some interesting questions about Joe Dick and his attitude and so forth, so...
November 6, it's Gary Cooper time, high noon. Had my flying dream again last night. I'm free, riding the thermals over a rocky beach, and whoosh, all the air gets sucked out of the sky by some god with a straw, and I fall, watching the rocks grow larger below, rushing up to meet my face, and I know if I hit them, I'll never wake up. I know I'm going to feel my teeth breaking into my mouth and my skull shattering and my brain splashing like wet clay into the tidal pools. As I fall, I know this is no benign passing from one world to a better one, but a jolt of unimaginable and pointless pain before a total and final negation and erasure of all that I am. So I figure I better wake up. All told, a shitty night's sleep. Joe hasn't slept in something like 32 hours. Probably scored some blow. Think he was hauling across or something.
So let's talk a little bit about the characters and particularly Bruce McDonald's approach to the characters in the film. What I really admire about how he approached this, and as you said, Tim, this was based on a book, so I don't know how close this follows the original book or how many liberties Bruce has taken with it, but I'll attribute it to him that you've got the Joe Dick character who's got his own motivations for getting the band together, and he's true to the art form. And he's asked by an interviewer, are you jealous of Billy Talent's his ambition to make it in a big band? He said, well, yeah, I'm jealous by the fact that he wants to do that rather than hang with us, but for the money, I'm not jealous at all, because it's the music, it's the band, that's the thing. So it could easily have fallen into a really sort of kitschy tale about true art versus capitalism. But Bruce McDonald never judges either character. He says, you've got legitimate reasons for what you want, and Billy Talent, you've got very legitimate reasons for doing what you want. And, I mean, really, in the end, I think to a degree, John Oxenberger and Pipe Fitter, it's they're peripheral characters. It's really more about the relationship between Joe Dick and
as much as people want to look at music as black and white and saying, well, there's the artist, there's art, and then there's commerce. I mean, it's never black and white. There's always the gray.
Correct.
Because I mean, it's not as cut and dried as people want to make it out to be. And I think that's what's really interesting is like the one thing that I find that really ties them both together, Joe Dick and Billy, is with Oxenberger's journal.
Yeah.
Where he's keeping this journal because he's kind of suffering from a little bit of mental illness.
You okay?
I can't find my prescription.
Your pills?
Yeah. And his journal is kind of his inner voice. He's able to kind of scribe out on a page. And he's saying, like you said earlier, Morris, he always thought he wasn't cool enough to have a alternate name.
Yep.
But he said, like these guys, Joe Dick and Billy Talent, gave themselves these names when they were kids.
Right.
And they're still calling themselves these names as adults. how long are they going to call themselves these names?
Mm.
You know, and it's like, how long are you going to live in this identity of delayed adolescence? You know, like, it's,
well,
I mean,
that's an interesting thing. Again, that's a difference between Joe Dick and Billy Talent. Joe Dick is still living that, you know, it's about the art. It's about the, you know, it's about living by this code of ethics. Whereas Billy Talent's more practical and, you know, they're approaching 40, they've got bills to pay. Why shouldn't I make a living off of this?
But in a way, you could also argue that really both of them are still living in adolescence because, like,
absolutely,
they've got to I'm sure there have been many articles in music journals and music magazines that say, right, well, has rock and roll grown old? Has rock and roll aged well? And these two characters, you know, regardless, neither of them are sort of willing to go take whatever the 9-to-5 job is going to be. They still want to see it, well, either for the art or for making a living. They're still going to make their living or do whatever in a band. And, you know, I'm not saying that's, you know, one way or the other. I think that Bruce is also asking the legitimate question, are these guys, in fact, actually beyond it? Are they supposed to be leaving it to the next generation of kids?
Yeah, yeah.
The next generation of Billy Talent and Joe Dick. So,
because
can you be a 45-year-old?
Because what's funny, it's like, you know, he's taking that stance that the 17-year-old kid would take where, you know, so-and-so sick, so he's out of the band, so I'm going to be in the band, so I'm going to be the guy. You know, it's like that's the kind of attitude that a kid would take.
Yeah.
Not an adult. You know, that's you know, where he's
– well, he's refusing
career objectives because the other guy – right, but the other guy's a junkie.
Yeah.
The other guy's in the hospital, and that's the only reason Billy's in. And then, you know, and then you see him initially where he throws the phone outside, and he's all pissed off. Like, fuck, man, the guy's back. And then he finds out later, no, he's not. And then, you know, I'm going to be in again. Like, you know, it's like he's got so much riding on this little pithy guitar gig that's, you know, it's just hilarious. And that there's a lot of reality to that because I've known bands that have been in that position with people. Same thing.
I wanted to sort of make a couple of quotes from the film that sort of illustrate the two sides to this. Because as we've gone and said, this film is done as a mock documentary, and so you get the moments where each one of the band members is being interviewed by Bruce. So there's a moment where, you know, Joe Dick is saying, well, you know, there's two ways to look at it. Billy just wants the models and limousines. I'm happy with the hookers and taxi cabs. And then within, I think, the same scene, you know, Billy says he's just fucked it up because he didn't want to take it up to the next level. And really, in those two sentences, that sort of describes, you know, what we've been talking about. I mean, you see plenty of other evidence of it on screen, but those two sentences, you know, like, you know, Joe is saying, right, all he's in it is for the money. I'm staying true to the form. And Billy's saying, well, you know, he's just happy to play the clubs and I want something a whole lot more and why not?
It's interesting as well. I think what the film captures really well is the time, because this was, what, 96 came out, didn't
right.
it? And this was that period where, you know, the underground, the punk scene, whatever, was beginning to be co-opted and become part of the mainstream. And it was actually viable that you could come from a punk band and actually go on to, you know, be a musician making interesting, talented music that, you know, was derived from punk. If you go back 10 years, you know, their kind of argument probably wouldn't have been, or their issues with each other probably wouldn't have been as valid because, you know, that kind of scene, that kind of thing wasn't quite happening yet. So
well,
I think it catches
one thing,
that sort of transitionary period really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you, Bern, 100%. But one thing I was going to say was the one thing I like about this film is how it's, you know, like you were talking earlier, Morris, about being meta with Bruce McDonald, you know, hiring Bruce, the director of the actual movie and whatever. Well, it goes beyond that, where the one thing I love about this film is that they actually blend a lot of reality into the film where, for example, you know, of course, you've got Joey Ramone talking about Hardcore Logo.
The Bucky Hit was a really good friend of mine. Someone shoot your friend, you gotta do something about it. You know, what Hardcore Logo are doing is a really cool thing.
And then you've actually got, like, when they're playing that first gig at the Commodore Ballroom in Vancouver, DOA is playing.
Yeah, I thought that was DOA. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're a legendary Canadian punk band that never really played stadiums or anything, but like, you know, but they're known like throughout North America as like legendary, but they never really went beyond the bar circuit, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was a guy named Art Bergman who was actually on stage there too. And Art Bergman's like a really well-known West Coast Canadian punk guy. He was legendary, like an actual real buck you hate. And then the Diodes, that were another Canadian punk band, they were up on there too. Because and the other nod to the Diodes is that they're driving at night and it's just Billy and Joe in the the front of the van, and they're sitting there singing, "I'm tired of waking up tired, waking up tired." That's an old Diodes song. Okay. So I mean, there's a lot of Canadian punk throughout this film that's saturated. So that's what I mean that it's great about this film is it's not like they're trying to kind of paint it as what they think it is. They're actually, you know, incorporating a lot of...
Yeah, it's genuine. It's real.
It is. Yeah. It's genuine, yeah.
It involves and is made by people who came from within that scene and they know what they're talking
right.
about. Yeah, yeah.
I've had friends in bands, you know, Central Ontario, like from Toronto area, that have done the run, that have gone across the prairies, the western part of Canada. And it's no joke. I mean, if you're doing it in the wintertime, it's brutal. And it's almost like an apocalyptic landscape because a lot of western Canada is just flat. And you see some of it when they're going past the giant wheat fields, like the wheat bales and everything else in the film. But it's so funny because I had a couple friends of mine. They're in this band called the Snow Dogs out of Toronto. And every time they do the western leg of their tour, they'd call it Das Boot, like you know, the sub film, because and that and the film and the Hardcore Logo, actually there's the bit when pipe fitters they got the hole in the roof of the truck,
right?
That little bubble where he's sticking his head up, he's looking around, right? And it's almost like he's in a sub or like a periscope or something, right? That made me laugh so much because like my buddies used to call it Das Boot because they were saying it's like, you know, you're in the tin can for so long and then you get like 2 hours of action and then you're back submerged again, back in the tin can, right?
Right.
So you're doing Das Boot, you know, because it's about a 25-hour run, even more across the prairies. Like it's and that's nonstop driving. I mean, you know,
huge.
Are the roads fairly straight or are they windy? Are they going around hills? I mean, that run that they did.
They're straight.
They're fairly straight.
And until you get up to the Rockies. And then when you get up to the Rockies, as soon as you hit the Rockies, they're all winding and everything. But along through Winnipeg, through Manitoba and Saskatchewan, it's just as straight as a ruler. But the thing is, I've known people that are the best of friends and that would never, ever say a bad word about the other one. And it's just like, I love you like a brother, man. I'm going to be the guy that buries you. You're going to be my best man at my wedding. And then they go and do a tour across the prairies. It's like, fuck you, cocksucker. I wish you were dead. You're dead to me. Right. No, like I've seen this, you know. So I understand perfectly. Like this film gets it perfect.
Fuck. Okay, let's get a few things in the open. Pipe, the hotel guy in Regina called. You shit on the fucking pillow, wipe your ass with a fucking bedspread. That, you know, that's uncool. I don't get that. What the fuck is that?
Didn't have no toilet.
No, that's nuts. Johnny, your fucking writing is nuts. You're not taking your medicine. You're fucking fueling something dangerous.
John, what do you know about danger?
Johnny,
danger
I'm trying
Will
to help
Robinson,
you.
Danger Will Robinson.
Johnny,
danger
I'm trying
Will
to help you. I'm trying to help you. You got to relax. We got 3 days left, and you got to chill. I'm your friend, and you got to chill. You must listen to me.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Oxenberger starts freaking out, and they're like, shut up, Ox. Shut up. And he's like, rah! You know. Or else it's like, where's my pills?
Yeah.
I don't know where your pills are. You know, it's like
when they pull into the roadside services place to get some food and pipe asleep. They just leave him.
Yeah.
They go in and carry on, and he wakes up and he's like, man, I'm really hungry. And they were like, dude, you slept through it. You missed it. He's like, I want to fucking turn back. You know, they're like, fuck you, dude.
Oh, yeah.
We're asleep.
That's really happened. I mean, there's bands. That's happened in bands.
Do you think that's the thing that band, when you've got 2, 3, 4 people just in a, like you say, a tin can amount of time, do you think people just fuck with other people in there just for amusement? Is it just, while sure. they play those
absolutely.
Hours. Yeah. Just
absolutely.
Being spiteful, yeah. mean for just, yeah, yeah, for a laugh, you know.
Because you know what it is? A lot, and people have even said this to me in the past, where it's almost like when you're drunk, where some people feel, well, hey, man, come on, I was drunk. I didn't mean it. I was drunk, mm-hmm. right, man? Like, come on. You know, it's like because you're in extenuating circumstances that everything is permissible, you know? And it's like,
right,
oh, come on, man. We were on the road, you know? Like, you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, it's like, come on, man. I didn't mean to dump that cup of piss on you, you know? It's just like, come on, you know? I'm just fucking with you, dude. Come on. I you know I love you, you know?
You mentioned something about the dome on top of the bus. And I made a note about that in relation to another point that I made. Okay, so the question I wanted to ask you guys was whether you thought that this film could have been made as a straight narrative as opposed to a mock documentary. And the only sort of point I want to make, I mean, I think it worked fine as it was. It could have worked the other way. But it seemed like in that bit where we're looking at Pipefitter looking at like a child through the dome, that all the photography or most of the photography that you see in the film looks like fly on the wall, intruding camera into a conversation. But that looked right. to me like a staged shot, like a real documentary. I don't think would have set up a shot like that. That's too staged. That's too narrative. And I mean, look, it's neither here nor there, but it just sort of struck me as odd. But anyway, so moving away from that for a second, just the question I asked both of you. So Bernie, you first. Do you think that this film could only have worked in the mock documentary style that it does, or could it have worked as a straight narrative?
I think it could have easily worked as a straight narrative. I think it's a stylistic choice to do it. Mm-hmm. as a documentary, and I think that brings certain things to it that would have been trickier to do as a straight narrative. But you flip the coin, if it had been done as a straight narrative, then they would have been able to do things that they weren't able in that sort of documentary format. So essentially I'm saying six of one, half dozen of the other. I think it would have worked either way,
right.
But I'm more than happy with how they chose to do it. I think it's, you know, I don't necessarily think it would have improved doing it mm-hmm. the other way, but right. Yeah, I'm sure I could have seen it working both ways. Yeah,
I mean, Spinal Tap notwithstanding, I mean, I can't remember, what were the dates of the other Christopher Guest films? I mean, were those, you know, Mighty Wind and
they were
the mid-90s, yeah, the mid-90s and on.
So this is going on at the same now, time as the Christopher Guest films?
Roughly, yeah, I reckon, yeah.
Maybe I'm way off here, but just indulge me for a minute. I think in a way, also, this film is kind of taking the piss with stuff like Werner Herzog, because... You know, like in the beginning when you're hearing the guy speaking in a different language and then you're hearing the bongos and there's a lot of stuff in this film that is kind of done almost like, you know, they do that in documentaries, but it's almost artsy for the sake of being artsy.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's some of this film in the beginning and there's other parts where it's just artsy for the sake of being artsy. And it's almost like they're kind of taking a swipe at some of these like kind of, you know, chin scratchers, you know, like Herzog and some of these other dudes, you know, where, you know, it's almost like he's trying to be highbrow and lowbrow at the same time.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Certainly towards the start, there's a couple of, like you say, the what I got from the bongos and that kind of thing. It made me think of Heart of Darkness.
Right.
And again, you know, they go on this journey. It's, you know, it is Heart of Darkness. It is Apocalypse Now to an extent, I guess, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
So, right.
Without the napalm, but.
I love the smell of weed in the morning.
I don't want to get into any spoilers, but Bernie, with the whole Bucky Hate thing, I was talking with Morris about this at another time. I got a real Rocky Erickson vibe from that guy.
I got more of a maybe John Lydon around the time of the Pistols. He was very in your face.
Yeah.
It felt very calculated as opposed to genuine. He was like really being weird and believing his own weirdness as opposed to genuinely being weird. That's kind of what I got from it, if you know what I mean.
But I kind of said it like with Rocky in the sense that he was a guy that was actually out there playing music.
Yeah.
And when everything became too much, he became insulated.
He withdrew into this kind of.
And he withdrew into it. And then, you know, it's like, well, you know, where everybody wanted to be close to him and wanted to kind of, you know, feel that vibe, you know, that he emanated. You know, like that's where Joe Dick is enamored with this guy.
Yeah.
And he's not, and he doesn't really know the guy. He's enamored with the mythology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. So then when he actually meets the guy, and the guy's just like, well, this is who I am. Is this what you think I am? You know? And then when the guy says, welcome to my world, here, drop some acid. And they're all like, whoa, you know? And it's like, shit, man. And he's just like, okay, you've had your ride. Now fuck off.
Fuck off, yeah.
Put it this way. Never back this way. Don't drop in.
And I wonder, like, that's how I got the feeling about Rocky, where there's so many people that think, you know, they're going to be around the guy. He's kind of like this energy source that emanates all this greatness or whatever. And then when you get close to the guy and you really see him for what he was, it's just kind of like,
it's interesting. Oh. I get what you're saying, but, and I don't know whether it was how it was written or how Richings, who played Bucky Haight, how he actually chose to play it. But like I say, I got from him more that he was a lot more self-aware of what he was doing. And it
right,
was almost,
he's more snide.
Yeah, and there was a kind of pretense to what he was doing. Whereas with Rocky, it was more of a genuine reaction because of his kind of mental frailty, I guess.
And but there's also the other side of it too, where Joe Dick is a snide motherfucker.
Yes.
And to everybody. And then all of a sudden when he comes to the guy that, you know, he loves, the guy's a snide motherfucker to Joe Dick.
There you go, yeah.
And it's right back in his face. And Joe Dick's like, when Joe Dick's standing there and he's got the goat blood on his face.
Yeah.
And Bucky says to him, did you have a good time? You know, like, did you get what you came for? You know, like, now fuck off. You know, like, that's it.
That's pretty much the only point in the film where Joe Dick is kind of not quite sure what to say or how to react as well, isn't it? That's the only time he's kind of a little disarmed.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, I guess it's undermining his foundation, isn't it? It's showing that maybe his life and these ideals that he believes in, maybe they're not sort of built on solid concrete, you know?
So can I
that's the only moment of clarity, really, in the whole film.
Yeah.
I was going to bring up another scene where I think it's a moment of pretense from Joe Dick. But, like, you know, because you've been saying it there, right? I mean, he was really very snide to most people, but he becomes like a pile of mush in front of Bucky Haight. But there's only one other moment where he's neither, where he actually sort of, I think, is putting on the pretense, but just because he's, I don't know if he's trying to do the right thing, he might hold contempt for this person. But there is one of the most awkward scenes in the film where after one of the gigs, there was a woman who the band had known from years before, a groupie.
Yeah.
And she's
moved. Oh, Mary. Yeah.
Mary!
Mary!
How you doing?
Oh, you know, I'm still
living
my life.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you met my husband, have you? Evan, this is Joe Dick.
I have.
Joe,
I have
Evan.
A pleasure to meet you.
And this is our daughter.
That's Sweeney. That's Sweeney. What's your name?
Billy. She's not usually so shy.
A little scared. Doesn't like the monster.
Anyway, you guys sound great. Better than ever.
Seriously?
Oh, come on. It was crazy.
Whoa. Seriously?
Yeah.
Then she gets a shirt. You want a t-shirt? What band?
Say thank
you. The boys.
Don't
best rock and roll band in North America. Nice meeting
you. Hey, thanks,
we'll see
you. Right. She's moved on. She's married now with 7 or 8 year old daughter who Mary's gone and named Billy. And you know, she's there with her husband and her daughter and she's indulging in safe nostalgia. And Joe Dick greets her politely, unlike anyone else who he'd greet, who would say, you know, yeah, oh, you like the show? Fuck off. But with her, the two of them share this moment of nostalgia. I mean, he can't wait in a way to get – he gives her a hug and then he sort of moves on to whatever, you know, snort some blow or have another drink. But that's the one moment where he treats someone, apart from Bucky Haight, treats them with a little bit of politeness. And, you know, he has no motivation for doing it. I thought it was, an interesting point that he didn't just treat her like shit.
They both share the nostalgia, though, that she sees it the way he sees it.
Right.
So he respects her. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, he's still, in his mind, living the dream of being in the band.
Right.
And she's showing, I'm here with my daughter and with my husband. You know, I've moved on, but let's talk for a minute or two about the old days.
it's interesting because I think the way he reacts to her implies that there's more going on there than you actually see. And so the conversation he has with Billy afterwards, and Billy's a little taken aback. And again, it sort of implies that maybe they've probably both had relations with her back in the day.
Well, Billy asked him. Billy asked him, did you fuck Mary? He said, in the van.
Well, and also the interesting thing, I kind of didn't twig this till afterwards, but right at the end of the film, when you get a "What are they doing now?" update, and he says he's involved in a paternity case with custody of his daughter.
Oh,
and it was only a little bit later. I thought, oh no, hang on a moment. Mary was like 8 years old, wasn't she? Oh, what's going on there? An awful lot is
the thing with
there.
Billy. That's really strange. Did you guys notice? Are you guys familiar with the Poppy family?
No.
The Poppy family? No, no.
The Poppy family, there was a guy named Terry Jacks from Canada, and he wrote Seasons in the Sun.
Okay,
you know that really famous song, right?
Yeah.
Well, he had a group called the Poppy family, and they had a really big hit in Canada, and that's actually in the States. Which way you going, Billy? So in the film, every time they're in a restaurant, and Joe's talking to Billy. In the background, you hear, "Which way you going, Billy?" And they're playing that. And it's almost like, you know, like, which way is he going? Is he going to stick with the band or is he going to go with Jennifer?
Wow. Oh, no, I didn't get that reference at all. That's really clever, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
There's all kinds of little things. And the other thing is that I really thought was funny about the relationship between Billy and Joe is when Oxenberg, when he wasn't on his medication, when he's talking to Mary, and he's going, well, I don't know why they're like that. And, you know, like, maybe it's that time that Joe fucked Billy in the ass that one night when he passed out.
Anyway, Joe pops Billy on the side of the head when he's not looking, and Billy flushes Joe's stash down the toilet. And then they just started wailing on each other. We didn't even make the stage. Major disaster all the way around.
They were fighting over movies?
No, that was just how they dealt with the real issue, which was Joe fucking Billy up the ass the night before.
What?
Mm-hmm. Probably out of spite. I wasn't there. Maybe it was a bet or a competition they had, or maybe they were trashed and Joe nailed Billy when he's passed out. Yeah, it's fake.
And she's like, what? It's almost like he's a tape recorder where he was just sitting in a room and nobody knew he was there, or they forgot he was there.
Yeah.
And they were just having this conversation between two of them, and he just got every single word, you know?
Yes. Little Billy, her daughter, ends up, you know, talking to Pipe Fitter, and he's the real child of the band. He's the only one who can talk to Billy and identifies with her, because as he's talking to her through the sandwich, "Oh, hello, Mr. Sandwich. Yeah. Are you going to eat me?" It's a very Spinal Tap moment in a way. Very quickly, so that we heard a few songs in the film. We are a music film podcast, so, you know, just the songs. Like, there was the main one that they played a few times in the film, "Who Do You Think You Are?" Did you enjoy the songs? Did you dig the song? I mean, that sounds like very old school punk. That did not belong in 90s punk, but they were an old band, possibly, you know, where they're struggling to sort of regain their audience.
Yeah, but again, that's kind of another detail they get exactly right, isn't it? They're playing
100%,
this stuff, which is...
absolutely.
But no, I thought it was great.
Because everything that was punk at that time, everything that was punk in the past, like, for example, Blondie, Devo, B-52s, Talking Heads, whatever you want. Today, kids would just say, "That's not punk." Well, that's not your punk, but that's what punk was. Yeah. And I mean, them doing Sonic Reducer, that was actually Hugh Dillon really singing. And them really, they really put a band together to do that. I mean, this wasn't other people singing those songs. This was these guys actually, they played that stuff.
Oh, I didn't realize. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, you can tell.
Yeah, they did. They did. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought that was great. You know, that they actually, you know, I mean, how the hell can you make a music documentary about a band and have a bunch of guys go up there and dub it over. Like, you couldn't. There's no way you could get away with that, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I tended to think that there were moments, ever since I was a young kid, I watched film clips or films, I watched the drummer. Because you can't tell from the guitar player or the bass player or the keyboard player. You can tell from the singer, maybe, and you can tell from the drummer. And there were moments where I was watching what pipe fitter was doing, think he's not playing that. Or, I mean, that's not to say that in the studio they didn't record with that guy behind the drums. I've no idea. But what we were seeing there was not a live performance. But, you know,
I think they did was they recorded as a band with those guys in the studio, and then they just dubbed it over, sure. But it was them playing it.
One of the greatest compliments I could give to these guys was that if I didn't know that this was a mock documentary, I really would have thought at times it was a documentary. The acting was just...
Yeah.
They were completely believable as a band. They were not just completely believable as the characters, but in their situations, you know, like... Even though you know, Pipe Fitter and John Oxenberger sometimes, you know, seemed a little bit more on the comedic side of things, you know, with Oxenberger, I lost my pills, and you don't necessarily completely always get the sense of desperation that he had, but yet his character was believable. You know, when he's waiting in the phone booth, he's saying to Bruce, "Hey Bruce, you have a girlfriend? You really ought to call her." That was believable. The drama between Joe and Billy was always believable. I think really the best thing I can say about these guys who they picked to make the film was everything that they did made me think, hang on, is this really a mock documentary?
Yeah.
Or is this the real thing?
It was I like the scene where they pull up to the club, and like the club's been closed for 2 weeks and no one even bothered to tell them. And they're like, you know, they're knee-deep in snow, and they all just fucking lose it with each other.
I don't fucking believe this. Joe, what the fuck is this?
Well, it wasn't fucking closed last week, and Mulligan booked it, so shut your fucking mouth.
Looks like their license was revoked.
Fantastic. What are you gonna do now, Joe? Manage?
Do yourself a favor, Billy. Fuck off.
So, what do we do, now?
Last night I sold fucking 20 t-shirts and made $100.
And then you fucking laughed at you. Shut up!
Look, Pipe Felcher, I've told you 5 times that I'm fucking sorry. So you shut the fuck up!
I tell you what, I got a proposal for you. You take all the money I got, and then the next fucking place we stop by, you can just give it all away.
You cheap fuck. You must have some money. Because you've been hogging down the deli trays. You can't be spending your per diems on food.
Oh, so I suppose you want your per diems back now, Mr. So-and-so.
Fuck, you're an idiot.
Well, you're a kook.
No, you're a fucking idiot.
And you're a kook.
And, yeah, it just feels so genuine. They're all pitch perfect in that scene. They are throughout.
The girl's giving an interview, and Joe says, "Hey, can you do me a favor? Can you fuck off, you know?"
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I've heard people say that.
Yeah.
So when I saw this film the first time back in 96, actually what was really cool was that I went and saw the film at my university theater. I think it was like 7 o'clock. The film got out at 9, and then I went and saw the Headstones play at 10:30 at the bar next door. So Joe was singing with his band.
Wow.
And I actually got to sit and talk to him about it, and he said it was the easiest thing he'd ever done. It wasn't hard at all. It was just, you know, I've lived it.
I hope he wasn't as much of an ass as Dick is. As I said earlier, I think his performance is amazing, because Joe Dick is, he's a giant asshole, but he's articulate, he's sharp, he's spiteful, he's kind of vulnerable as well, and there's sort of little chinks in his armor and all that stuff really, really well, I think.
Right.
See, that's the thing, he's treating people like shit, and he goes and tells people, yeah, you go fuck off, and yet the whole thing... He needs this group. He needs them as a gang.
Yeah.
He desperately wanted them to get back together, to get on the road. At one point, he goes and proposes to Billy. He says, "I love you, man. Maybe you and I should do something after this tour. Let's not worry about Pipe Fitter and Oxenberger. Just you and me." But he tries to think that he's talking the talk, but he's really very, very desperate. And we're not going to give anything away, but the resolution at the very end of the film shows just how much desperation there was. That came out of the blue. I had no expectation
that
was going to happen.
I was going to say, what do you guys, again, without giving anything away, what do you guys think about the ending?
His whole goal was to make sure the Hardcore Logo was legendary one way or another.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's like if it wasn't going to come one way, it was going to come another.
Right.
And that was it.
Yeah.
They're still going to talk about them, you know, years after they're gone.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, that was the band. With all the shit with Bucky Haight, where, you know, like they blew all this smoke up his ass and how he was a legendary guy and blah, 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 blah. And then the reality is the furthest thing from the truth.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's the legend.
That's right.
It's the hype. It's everything that comes with that.
Yeah.
So in the end, it's like, well, if it wasn't going to come one way.
Yeah, it's certainly a logical vision of what's come before.
So I
don't know if I liked it personally, but that was just on a purely oh shit kind of level, as opposed to
right,
you know, it kind of made sense. So, yeah.
Tim, are you suggesting that Bucky Haight is like the little man behind the green curtain in The Wizard of Oz?
Absolutely,
yeah.
You know, and this is the thing, you know, about really, you know, the only reason that people kind of, you know, admire musicians and artists and athletes or whatever. Half the time it's because they've never met them.
Right.
They've never actually spent time with them. They've never really seen them, you know, suffer and have to go through all their foibles and everything else. And I mean, when you realize that, you know, that these people are just fuck ups, just like you and I, it really kind of deflates, you know, the image, you know, and that's it.
And like you say, people would much prefer to believe the legend, the story, the romance version than they actually would deal with the fact that, you know, people are flawed and assholes and make wrong decisions. So, and
So I know we don't do grades here at See Here, but I put it out to you guys. Did I do all right with this one? Like thumbs up or thumbs down, or what did you think about it?
Yeah.
Two thumbs up. For me. Absolutely. Two thumbs up.
Excellent film. I'm surprised it's not more well known, to be honest. I think it's an excellent film. It's just got a lot going for it. I'm surprised people don't know about it.
In Canada, it's been registered as one of the best 10 Canadian films ever made.
Wow.
Well, if I was Bruce McDonald, I'd be proud to have said, I made that. That really, that could be anyone's top 10, any list that you want to make.
Nice. The last thing I want to say about this film to me is that this film would go alongside another film that we've actually covered to See Here really well, as far as I'm concerned, and that would be The Fabulous Stains.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah,
I like this because I like this a lot better than The Fabulous Stains.
The Fabulous Stains is like the kind of
what I could see
glow bubblegummy version of this, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that there's two perspectives of life on the road. There's the idea of, you know, like a Svengali or somebody putting a band together, and then, you know, the band itself, like, you know, like you say, you know, there's the sweet and there's the sour, you know?
Yeah.
There's another film which I'd forgotten the name of for many, many years, and I know I must have come across a forum sometime last year and remembered it was called Bandwagon. I'd seen it in the cinema back in the 90s. And it was another case of a film about a band, although this was not about a band that had seen better days. This was, you know, a bunch of guys who were getting together for the first time, all very different characters, and they sort of get round together around this one particular set of songs written by their songwriter, and they go on the road, but for reasons which are not – the truth does not come out until later on in the film. So – anyone out there who's if you haven't seen Bandwagon, look this up. Came out in 1996-1997, not to be confused with the Sid Charisse film from the 1950s, The Bandwagon, just Bandwagon. I remember asking, I think on the Feed My Ears group or maybe the Gentleman's Guide group, does anyone remember a film there was a poster of a train track with an acoustic guitar on it, and no one could remember it. But somewhere along the line, I came across a forum where someone made mention of that film. That's the one. The whole film's on YouTube in 10 parts. It had been put up back in the days before you could get like a whole 90-minute, two-hour film onto YouTube. But the whole film is still there in 10-minute parts. I urge you to go see it and maybe make a comparison between Hardcore Logo and Bandwagon. Bandwagon is, I wouldn't say it's a bubblegum version of this, but it's, you know, it's not as well, not as hardcore as Hardcore Logo, but it's still but it is a great film, and it does have you'll watch it, you'll see it has a lot of similarities. And you know, when I was really happy to watch again, and was quite happy that at the end of it, when I watched it again last year, I thought, you know what, I still like it, it still holds up. So so that was a delight. Cool. are we all done with this? Any final words, or are we ready to ask
the only thing The only thing I want to say is that this film might be a little bit hard to find for some. You're going to have to either find it via Amazon or you're going to have to buy an actual physical copy, because I think Netflix and some of the streaming sites won't have this anymore.
Right.
So this is a film that you're really going to have to dig up if you really want to watch it. And I highly recommend it. The DVD that I actually got, the copy that I've got now, is Quentin Tarantino saw this and he was so enamored with the film that he actually put it out as part of his the traveling roadshow or whatever he called that, his
show
his
pictures
line.
Or whatever, because he did that
with a couple of Wong Kar Wai films, I think. In the Mood for Love, I think he might have done that for, or was it for Happy Together, one of the Wong Kar Wai films, I'm pretty sure he did that for as well.
He did it with
Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder. That's what it was called, right. Rolling Thunder.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, you're right, Rolling Thunder. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, this was part of his Rolling Thunder releases. The DVD that I got of it.
Bernie, your choice for May. Let's have it.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about the counterculture. We're going to be going back to the '60s.
Ooh.
We are going to visit Alice's Restaurant.
Holy moly!
There you go.
Nice.
That's a very cool choice.
Nice.
It's been on my roadmap for a while, and I shouldn't say anything about it now, but it's funny, last night I was thinking, oh God, I've got to think of a film to do next month, and I was weighing up all the pros and cons of different ones. I had about three in my mind, and then this just popped into my head, and I thought, fuck, we got to do Alice's Restaurant. Perfect.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I grew up.
There you go.
I grew up with Arlo. I grew up with Arlo through my dad. My dad used to play Arlo all the time, and I kind of caught shit because of Arlo, because we did a show and tell when I was in grade 3 or 4, and I went up and sang a little song in front of my class, and I was singing, coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags, if you please, Mr. Customs Man.
Well, it sounds like we've all got a bit of history with Arlo and with this film, so it should be an discussion next month.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Looking forward to it. And what I really want to do is maybe next month I'll dig out the guitar and we can record the three of us singing the song in three-part harmony.
I'm game if you guys are.
When it comes around again on the guitar in three-part harmony. All right. Okay, so Alice's Restaurant, a true piece of counterculture. You know what? That film would probably be, in a way, a good double bill with The Monkey's Head. I think I'd like.
Oh,
which,
yeah,
funnily enough, was one of the other films I was considering. How about that? It's like we're on some kind of telekinetic.
You know what?
Well,
here's the thing.
That was a given, man. Given. I mean,
you know what? I covered that film with Terry Frost on Love That Album a while ago. But you know what? I'd be more than happy at some stage to cover it again on See Here and cover it with you guys. So please.
See, the problem is, when thinking of films to cover here on See Here, because of what Terry Frost has been doing and also Mike White over at the producer's booth, any time I come up with something, I think, oh, yeah, Mike's covered that. And, you know, he's done an 8-hour episode on it. So.
but you know what?
Terry's covered that at some point. So.
But even Mike was more than happy to cover Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park the second time to do it with us. So, he's happy for it. And I'm sure, you know, Terry wouldn't be possessive, so.
You know what? The people demand to know what we think about these things.
Correct.
Absolutely. We're justified in doing this.
So that'll happen somewhere along the way. All right. But anyway, so next month you can get anything you want at See Here Podcast. Bernie has spoken. We will get what we want at Alice's Restaurant. So tune in for that in May 2016. So housekeeping details. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at seeherepodcast at gmail.com, or you can join our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/seehear. That's SEEHEAR. You can download us from either iTunes or from our website, seehere.podbean.com. And please do get in contact with us, because, you know, we like to know that people are listening to us. And, you know, we want to
thank you all for listening.
Can I just add something?
Yes, yes, please.
If you guys don't mind, I just wanted to give a shout out to a couple of other podcasts, because they're always extremely kind and let us talk about See Here and publicise new episodes in their Facebook groups and so on.
Absolutely.
So just, I want to give a little bit of love and thanks to the Cult of Muscle. to silver and gold.
Ugh.
Fart noise. There we go. Nice. And of course, to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, the granddaddy of all of them. So thank you, guys. They're a great podcast. And if you don't listen to them, what the hell is wrong with you?
Get
those should
on
be the first three podcasts you listen to after you listen to See Here. So
yeah, but I mean, listen to us first because we're insecure, like Joe Dick. But after that,
it all begins with Willie and Sam. What can I say?
Yeah, exactly. We're all their stepchildren, aren't we?
We
yeah.
are.
Yep.
Willie,
yep.
Sammy, yep. Thank you. All right, so while I think Tim needs to go get a whiskey and lemon tea, so we'll let him go get that. But meanwhile, thank you so very, very much for listening. Hope you've enjoyed the show.
Thank you.
Please, be nice to each other. Watch some great films. Listen to some fantastic music. And just don't be a Joe Dick to each other. Until next time, see ya.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.